Hello and welcome to The Economist. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we're reading this week from the August 2nd through 8th edition of The Economist. We'll begin, as usual, with The Leaders, a collection of six articles this week, chosen by Economist editors to represent the major events and themes of the week. The first, and this is the cover story, Greenlash, The Climate Needs a Politics of the Possible. Subheading, to win voters' consent, policymakers must offer pragmatism and hope. Second, Transatlantic Trade Truths, What Opponents of the EU-US Trade Deal Get Wrong. Subheading here is Internal Reform Matters More Than External Trade. Third, block off the old chips. America is easing chip export controls at exactly the wrong time. Subheading, the ban on sales to China was working and should be kept in place. Fourth, just passing time. Spain's scandal-plagued prime minister should step down. Subheading, Pedro Sanchez needs to let his country's democracy renew itself. And fifth, bad protocol. The world needs a better way to share genetic information. Subheading, that will involve a wholesale rethink of the Nagoya Protocol. And sixth, and finally, the What For Declaration. In recognizing Palestine, Britain and France won't advance peace. Subheading, they could even set it back. Following the reading of those six leaders' articles, we'll turn to the main section of the magazine for articles from the United States, the Americas, Asia, China, Middle East and Africa, Europe, and Britain, all, of course, as time allows. So, turning now to that first leaders' article, and this is the cover story this week. The title is Greenlash, The Climate Needs a Politics of the Possible. Subheading, to win voters' consent, policymakers must offer pragmatism and hope. Curbing climate change was never going to be easy. The fundamental energy balance of a planet cannot be changed overnight, nor can a fossil fuel-based economy that serves billions of people be replaced without furious political objections. But today, the problem looks particularly hard. On July 29th, continuing President Donald Trump's gutting of efforts to reduce emissions, America's Environmental Protection Agency said it would renounce its main authority to regulate greenhouse gases. That goes along with his reckless attacks on climate science. In Europe, the war in Ukraine has spurred growth in defense budgets, squeezing spending on green policies, which also faced renewed political opposition. Some voters think the cost of cutting emissions is too high or should fall on others. In poor countries, which have historically emitted far less than rich ones, many resent green policies they see as foreign and heedless of the desperate local need for energy. Sensing the political winds, big global firms have gone quiet about greenery, although many still pursue it. None of this deprives the world of its technical ability to decarbonize a great deal of its economy. On that score, things have never looked better. The cost of clean energy is tumbling as the demand for it grows. The problem is politics. Many people do not believe that the strict net zero targets to which some governments have tied their climate policies are in their interest, or that they will bring benefits to anyone else. Some think they're being taken for chumps, paying good money to meet bad targets, while businesses and people elsewhere are belching out carbon, chuckling as they do. Seeing an ever more powerful China emitting more than Europe and America combined makes resentful Western voters seethe. The scientific rationale for net zero is strong. An end to warming requires the level of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere to stop increasing. That means either a world with no such emissions, or one which takes as much greenhouse gas out of the atmosphere as it puts in. That's the net. In net zero. The logic is inescapable. The political rationale is clear too. Saying you'll hit net zero by a certain date is a definite goal and it's easily articulated. But hard, ambitious targets do have advantages. You never know for sure what can be done until you try. However, reaching net zero in the nearish future would require emission cuts to be quick, deep, and painful. For countries which have not yet seen any decline in emissions, which worldwide is most of them, the steepest cuts would have to come very early. In many cases, such scenarios are barely physically imaginable, let alone politically feasible. If a target is so hard that it cannot win consent, then it needs to be changed. But how? For rich countries to abandon stringent net zero targets outright would demoralize Greens, energize climate nihilists, and make sensible reforms harder. Better to find ways to ease them into the, quote, more of a guideline, end quote, category. There will be resistance from those who believe that all problems can be solved by more political will, but as a famously iron-willed German once said, politics is the art of the possible. Better to be Bismarck. Some politicians do get it. Mark Carney, Canada's prime minister and an economist, understands that in many situations, the most efficient way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is to tax them. But many voters hate such taxes, so he's been quick to rescind the aspects of Canada's carbon pricing scheme that affect them directly. Instead of charging for pollution, many governments have subsidized its avoidance. Some subsidies have borne fruit. Extra demand has driven the virtuous cycle of larger volumes and lower prices that have seen wind, solar, and batteries become more available and cheaper. Costs are now so low that unstimulated demand will drive them even lower. That more or less guarantees a growing amount of decarbonization come what may. Even post Big Beautiful Bill, America will see its emissions shrink, albeit more slowly than they could have. Nonetheless, subsidies still distort markets and reduce emissions less cheaply than a carbon price normally would, so it makes sense to charge for emissions when it's politically feasible, for example, when it does not affect voters directly. Governments should also scrap the many subsidies that harm the climate, such as those still applied to fossil fuels. They should try harder to reduce the pain inflicted when decarbonization involves lots of ordinary people. Do not bully them into buying heat pumps when there are too few technicians to install them. Make switching to an electric car easier by building charging infrastructure and letting in cheap imports from China. Apply the same pain-reducing logic to adaptation. Marine Le Pen, the leading French populist, struck a chord when she complained that France's elite had air conditioning, but its masses did not. America will play an unusual role so long as Mr. Trump is in charge, as a cautionary tale. Some promising clean energy technologies, such as advanced geothermal and possibly even fusion, now have bipartisan support, but Mr. Trump's war on climate action will leave the country worse off at a time of rising energy demand, some of it needed to power artificial intelligence, a national security priority. Prices will rise. Efforts to establish an American renewables industry to rival China's, will wither. Voters everywhere prefer cleanliness to pollution and a future in which they can thrive to one that looks dangerous. There are more potent rallying cries than an abstract target. Stories that make people feel they're participating in progress still play well. The idea of not being subject to swings in fossil fuel prices is attractive too. The art of the possible may sound flat, but a politics of new possibilities could put climate policy on a more sustainable footing, as well as offering hope. That is what those fighting climate change need to offer. And our second Leaders article today is titled Transatlantic Trade Truths: What Opponents of the EU-US Trade Deal Get Wrong. Subheading, Internal Reform Matters More Than External Trade. The critics were quick to jump in. Soon after the European Commission struck its trade deal with President Donald Trump on July 27th, It was being savaged in European capitals. François Bayrou, the French prime minister, called it a dark day when an alliance of free peoples united to affirm their values and defend their interests resolves to submit, end quote. Friedrich Merz, Germany's chancellor, worried about severe damage, as he put it, to the German economy. Viktor Orban, Hungary's populist leader, twisted the knife, saying Mr. Trump, quote, ate Ursula von der Leyen for breakfast, end quote. The deal is certainly unlike any other the EU has struck before. Exports to America will face a tariff of 15%, lower than the 30% that had been threatened had no deal been struck, but nearly 10 times as high as the rate that prevailed before Mr. Trump returned to the White House. In turn, the EU will eliminate its own tariffs on imports of American industrial goods and provide easier access for some farm produce. The bloc is also expected to buy more energy from America and invest hundreds of billions across the Atlantic. For those who see trade as a zero-sum game in which deficits are for losers and exporters are winners, the EU got fleeced. The naysayers are misguided, however. Unfortunately, Mr. Trump's love of tariffs means the old days of low duties are not coming back while he's in power, and the deal is not as catastrophic as its critics claim. The EU has secured similar terms to Japan's, so its relative trading position remains the same. Cars made in Europe will no longer face higher sectoral duties, and the EU has not had to surrender its plans to regulate digital services, which mainly hit America's tech giants. Some bemoan the asymmetry of the deal, that European manufacturers face tariffs while Americans gain market access. But trade is not a zero-sum game. European consumers will benefit from greater choice and lower prices, whereas the bulk of the tariff cost will be borne by American businesses and shoppers, even if some foreign firms do cut their prices. Last, the broader geopolitical context means that escalation never an attractive option for the EU. If trade were the only thing on the agenda, the bloc could have better afforded to hit back in the hope of forcing America to relent. But, quote, it is also about security. It is about Ukraine, end quote. So says Maros Sefcovic, the EU's trade commissioner, about the negotiations. Because Europe has for decades outsourced its security to America, it needed to offer trade terms that would keep a mercurial president happy and willing to stay engaged in Europe. The EU's critics ignore the fact that its problems run deeper than a single trade deal. The economy badly needs reform, innovation, and investment, as Mario Draghi, a former head of the European Central Bank, laid out in a colossal report in 2024. Mr. Trump's 15% transatlantic tariff pales in comparison with the cost of internal trade frictions. The IMF reckons barriers within the EU amount to a staggering 44% tariff on goods and 110% on services. Europe's capital markets are too shallow and fragmented to fund risky, innovative ideas, and the continent is far from adding the extra investments needed to close the productivity gap. Rather than focusing on what America is doing wrong, the EU should look closer to home. Member states are stymieing reform. Germany is loath to boost its own capital markets, let alone integrate capital markets across Europe. France is the biggest obstacle to making more trade deals that would help diversify exporters' markets. Almost a year since the Draghi report, barely any of its recommendations have been acted upon. Damaging as a trade war would have been, it might at least have shaken politicians out of their torpor. Instead of pointing fingers, the critics should be rolling up their sleeves. And our third leader's article is titled, Block Off the Old Chips. America is easing chip export controls at exactly the wrong time. Subheading, the ban on sales to China was working and should be kept in place. In the 6 months since China stunned the world with DeepSeek, its progress in artificial intelligence has continued to impress. In July alone, three labs unveiled top-flight AI models, matching and in some cases even beating America's best. The bosses of America's leading model maker say that advanced AI, able to outperform the average human at all cognitive tasks, could be just a few years away. And the race is not just commercial, but geopolitical. The country that gets to superintelligence first would enjoy mighty military advantages, too. This is the backdrop against which the Trump administration has abruptly changed its mind on the export of America's world-beating AI chips to China. In April, it blocked the sales of NVIDIA's H20 chips to the People's Republic. On July 14th, the firm said it had been given permission to resume them. The U-turn came shortly after a meeting at the White House between President Donald Trump and the boss of NVIDIA, Jensen Huang. NVIDIA is the world's most valuable company, and its fortunes move markets to a president who views the S&P 500 as a personal approval tracker. That may give it sway that other firms lack, but even without the grubby optics, the decision is a grave mistake at the worst possible time. That is because, as impressive as Chinese models have been, America's chip controls were clearly working. When NVIDIA devised the H20 to comply with an earlier set of rules, it inadvertently created a chip that was hobbled for training new AI models, but perfect for running them, a process called inference. Since exports of the H20 were banned in April, even the Chinese labs that had overcome the shortage of training chips to produce world-class AI models have been unable to access enough computing capacity to offer those models to paying customers. They've had to resort to relying on outsourced hosting and making most of the limited quantity of AI chips produced by Huawei and other Chinese hardware firms. But the trend seems clear. Without H20s, Chinese companies can't keep up with demand. And as AI adoption increases, having enough capacity for inference will become ever more important, making export controls even more potent. America's ban on the export of H20s, in short, has impeded China's progress in AI. It seems perverse for America, engaged in an arms race with China, to give up this advantage. Moreover, rapid progress in AI argues for restricting chip sales now, even if that ends up boosting China's hardware industry in the longer term. There's no question that blocking Chinese firms' access to foreign inputs has stimulated demand for Chinese alternatives. It has turbocharged innovation and the development of an alternative ecosystem in a way that even President Xi Jinping and his deep pockets could not manage. China's domestic chip makers remain years behind the industry's cutting edge, but export controls have strengthened their commercial incentive to catch up. America thus faces a trade-off. It can limit China's AI software industry at the expense of emboldening its AI hardware industry in the longer term, or vice versa. Mr. Trump's AI advisor, David Sachs, says allowing chip exports will make China dependent on America's technology ecosystem and discourage it from developing its own. The more Chinese firms use NVIDIA's chips, goes the argument, the harder it will be for Huawei or other local firms to develop a commercially viable alternative. America's Commerce Secretary says he wants China to be addicted to American chips. Yet, given the stakes of the AI race, the risk that China's hardware supply chain will be strengthened in the long run is worth taking. The fiendish complexity of chip making means catching up will take years. And if there is even a small chance that the time frame for AI development suggested by America's AI leaders is correct, the race for superintelligence may have been won by 2030. Accordingly, America should do everything it can to win that race in the short term, even if it means it fails to hamper the development of China's hardware industry in the longer term. NVIDIA's comparison. When it comes to many of the ingredients of artificial intelligence, China measures up well against America. It has deep reservoirs of talent, data, and capital, and plenty of power-generating capacity. Chips, however, are its Achilles heel, as artificial intelligence models wow the world, and even bigger advances loom on the horizon, it's foolish for America to give its main geopolitical rival any assistance. And our fourth leader's article is titled Just Passing Time. Spain's scandal-plagued prime minister should step down. The summary, Pedro Sanchez needs to let his country's democracy renew itself. Spaniards seem to be doing well these days, especially compared with some of their neighbors. Since 2022, growth in their economy has far outpaced that of the euro area as a whole. Unemployment, though still over 10%, is at its lowest since 2008, and this is despite a sharp rise in the minimum wage since Pedro Sanchez, a socialist, became prime minister in 2018. Mr. Sanchez has passed a useful labor reform, strengthening the welfare state, welcomed immigrants, and taken the European lead in recognizing a Palestinian state. His supporters see him as a last bastion of social democracy against the hard right. Despite leading a minority government, Mr. Sanchez has kept the country ticking over pretty well. Until now, that is. The prime minister emerged weaker from a snap election he called 2 years ago, at which the mainstream Conservatives People's Party, or PP, won the most votes. He clung on in the Moncloa Palace because his motley crew of allies, the hard left, as well as the Catalan and Basque nationalists, preferred him to voting with Vox, a hard right outfit. But he has paid a price for their increasingly unreliable support. In the past few weeks, Mr. Sanchez has also been badly hurt by a corruption scandal. The two men he picked to run the Socialist Party for him since 2018 both now face trial for taking bribes on public contracts, which they deny. Recordings indicate that one of them hired prostitutes together with an associate, hypocritical in a party that proposes to ban prostitution. On Mr. Sanchez's orders, the two party leaders ruthlessly sidelined internal critics, and that means he has no one else to blame. Polls show that Spaniards are more disillusioned with their politicians than any other Europeans, apart from Bulgarians, Greeks, and Slovenes. Mr. Sanchez has repeatedly apologized for his aide's transgressions, but that's not enough. To restore faith in Spanish democracy, the prime minister should take responsibility and step down. There's no good reason for him to stay on. Spain's economic growth predates him and owes him rather less to his reforms than to those of his conservative predecessor, Mariano Rajoy. It would continue after him. He has placed political lackeys in supposedly independent institutions, and he hasn't managed to pass a budget since 2023. It's now Mr. Sanchez's allies, not his party, who set the agenda. He's more vulnerable to their policy blackmail. The only weighty legislation passed in the current parliament was an amnesty for those involved with an illegal attempt by Catalan separatists to secede from Spain. This has damaged the credibility of democratic politics. Mr. Sanchez opposed it as unconstitutional until he needed Catalan nationalist votes to stay in office. Spain's NATO partners reluctantly agreed to let the country raise defense spending to just 2.1% of GDP rather than 3.5% like the rest. But Mr. Sanchez has not dared seek parliamentary approval even for this, since the hard left would vote against it. A bill that would give the government-appointed public prosecutor instead of judges control over judicial police looks to critics like an attempt to shut down investigations into his circle. Another ill-advised bill seeks to impose a 37.5-hour week with no loss of pay all on all businesses. Mr. Sanchez came to office thanks to a censure motion against Mr. Rajoy after the courts condemned PP politicians for corruption. That he has not yet fallen in the same way owes everything to Vox. Other parties fear that voting the PP into office would mean a government backed by the xenophobic populists of the hard right. Yet, that need not be the case. There are two other ways Spain's paralysis could end. One would be for Mr. Sanchez to call a party congress and hand over leadership to a party elder. The prime minister has made confrontations with the PPP as well as Vox his method of government. A different leader could seek a constructive relationship with the moderate opposition. The second route would be an early election. Mr. Sanchez would probably lose it. But 2 more years of ineffectual gamesmanship will only further tarnish the positive aspects of his legacy. The Prime Minister should use his summer holiday to ponder the interests of his party and his country and act accordingly. And our fifth leader's article is titled Bad Protocol: The World Needs a Better Way to Share Genetic Information. And that will involve a wholesale rethink of the Nagoya Protocol. Biology is in the middle of a transformation. Over the past 5 years, new sequencing techniques have made it much easier and cheaper to read long strands of DNA, allowing scientists to record gapless genomes with much less uncertainty than before. Scientists are keen to put these capabilities to good use. One ambitious proposal is the Earth Biogenome Project, a moonshot idea to sequence all the planet's eukaryotic life, that is, all plants, animals, fungi, and so on. This would help scientists uncover the hidden handiwork of evolution, monitor how endangered species respond to global warming, and mine genomes for useful biological compounds such as new antibiotics. Unfortunately, the project faces big obstacles. One is the Nagoya Protocol, which was supposed to make the biosciences fairer and more efficient. Enforced since 2014, the protocol asserts countries' sovereign right to negotiate access to genetic resources on their land. Although well-intentioned, it has made sharing biological samples across borders harder and has not generated benefits for biodiverse countries, many of them poor. It should be scrapped and replaced with something better. Sequencing is not the only work being hampered by the protocol's red tape. Microbiological research, especially on pathogenic bacteria and viral strains, has often been obstructed too. Brazilian researchers working under Nagoya-like rules were prevented from sharing samples of the Zika virus during an outbreak in 2016. Likewise, with the MERS virus in Saudi Arabia in 2013, when some Nagoya principles were already in place under the Convention on Biological Diversity, of which the protocol is an offshoot, and that slowed vital research, including on vaccines. The idea behind the protocol is a noble one. It sought to enable countries to share in the benefits generated from their genetic resources and to ensure that stewards of biodiversity would not be relied upon for their work and knowledge without proper compensation. The intent was to protect poor countries in particular from being exploited by researchers and businesses from the rich world. But the protocol has not only failed to achieve its aims, it has been counterproductive. Rather than helping biodiverse countries get their due, it is more often imposing a burden on them. As of 2023, more than 80% of countries that have ratified the protocol had yet to issue a single permit, meaning that those countries have received no benefit, monetary or otherwise. Many have no adequate processes in place to facilitate permits. In other places, local scientists seeking permits describe needing to know people if they are to find their way around countries' systems. As a consequence, foreign researchers have at times pulled back from collaborating with colleagues in poor countries, and after years of delay, the Wellcome Sanger Institute in Britain had to reallocate funds from some projects with scientists in countries that have ratified the protocol to projects in countries that have not. Countries are entitled to make their own laws, but the current framework is complex and unworkable. That's not just a bad deal for countries providing samples. The world at large is foregoing the benefits of research when biodiversity is under huge pressure. The threat of pandemics looms large, and biology at last has the tools to make important progress. That is why the protocol needs to make way for a better system. One might draw inspiration from another offshoot of the CBD called the Kali Fund. This will create a financial mechanism for companies to pay for genomic sequences rather than samples. Like copyright collection societies, it will allow data to be shared easily through online databases in exchange for payment into a central fund responsible for compensating sequence-providing countries. A similar system for sharing physical samples could lessen the administrative burden on the poorest countries by removing the need for permits and enabling collaboration. If some of the money that was generated went towards building technical capacity in poor countries, they could more easily take part in international research on an equal footing. That would create value not just for the planet's myriad creatures, but for fledgling scientific communities everywhere. And at the halfway mark in today's broadcast, we remind you, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we are reading from the August 2nd through August 8th edition of The Economist. And our sixth and final Leaders article is titled The What For Declaration. In recognizing Palestine, Britain and France won't advance peace. They could even set it back. Gaza is in the grip of an incipient famine amid a futile war that neither Hamas nor Israel appears ready to end. In an attempt to highlight the suffering of the Palestinians, stop the fighting, and save the idea of two countries for two peoples, Britain and France have in recent days both taken decisive steps toward the recognition of a Palestinian state. The Economist wholeheartedly shares those aims, but we doubt that recognition will further them. Indeed, we worry that recognition on the terms set out by Britain and France could get in the way. France moved first on July 24th when its president, Emmanuel Macron, announced he will recognize Palestine at the UN General Assembly in September. 5 days later, Britain's Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, said that Britain would follow suit, but added he would hold back if Israel stopped the war, clearly committed itself to a two-state solution, and pledged not to annex Palestinian territory in Gaza or the West Bank. Those demands are unlikely to be met, meaning that Britain, too, is likely to go ahead. It's easy to depict this as a virtue signaling by unpopular leaders keen to curry favor at home. Mr. Macron has lost much of his domestic authority. Sir Keir is losing control over his own party, which is strongly pro-Palestinian, with grave implications for the rest of his term in office. Despite this, France's president and Britain's prime minister deserve to be taken at face value. The chief test of their announcements, in other words, is whether recognition is likely to advance their aims in the Middle East. One answer put forward by President Donald Trump is that recognition is simply irrelevant. He scoffed at Mr. Macron's pledge, doesn't carry any weight. And you can see what he means, given that 147 of the 193 members of the UN already recognize a Palestinian state. Two more are unlikely to make much difference. However, although Britain and France no longer matter as much as they used to, they still count for something, which is one reason Israel's government has reacted angrily to their change in policy. As permanent members of the UN Security Council and members of the G7, they're keen to sway other countries that are considering recognition. And sure enough, on July 30th, Canada said it would also recognize Palestine in September, subject to some conditions. Britain has added an historical role because in the Balfour Declaration, issued in 1917, it acknowledged the need for a Jewish homeland and promised to help bring one into being. To the extent that either country has any influence, even at the margin, they should surely use it. Or what is influence for? The argument for acting now is that the Israeli government, under its Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, will be shocked into realizing his country is losing the support of even long-term allies. Britain and France cannot compel Israel to change course, but in order to avoid becoming a pariah, Mr. Netanyahu may sue for peace. Because America is not pressing Israel forcefully enough, Europe's two main diplomatic powers must step in. It is a weak foundation on which to rest Middle East policy. For one thing, Mr. Netanyahu and his ministers are more likely to dig in their heels than suddenly give ground. Many of them assess correctly that European governments will condemn them, whatever they do. Yielding to demands today will only lead to more tomorrow. Some in Israel have concluded they should do whatever they want now, despite criticism from abroad, and try to rebuild relations later. If Israel has already paid the, albeit small, price of recognition, Mr. Netanyahu and his government may, if anything, become more extreme. The other problem is that if talks about the two states begin again under a new Israeli prime minister, both sides will need to make concessions to bring them to a successful conclusion. Yet using recognition as leverage over Israel today means that Britain and France have deprived themselves of leverage over the Palestinian side tomorrow. This is not a trivial thing to surrender because the two-state deal will face many obstacles, including the details over territory and security. Unfortunately, Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, looks unlikely to give ground willingly. He only recently denounced Hamas's murderous attacks of October 7, 2023. For the first time, he has repeatedly failed to hold elections and lacks the legitimacy to speak for Palestinians as a whole. In the immediate future, that same logic confounds Sir Keir's wheeze to make recognition of Palestine a threat rather than a promise. The Prime Minister says he's acting now because he's determined to end the fighting in Gaza, and at the margin he may be able to exert some influence over Israel, but he's not threatened to withhold support for recognition if Hamas refuses to release hostages or to end the war. That potential reward gives Hamas an incentive to block a ceasefire until after the UN General Assembly in September. Yet once Hamas has pocketed Britain's prize, Sir Keir will have lost his leverage over Israel. It's a self-defeating policy that fails on its own terms, even supposing Israel is susceptible to pressure. The truth is that Britain and France have most influence over Israel indirectly through Mr. Trump. He's the only leader who can press Netanyahu into the ceasefire he says he wants. America is essential for keeping alive the prospect of a lasting peace. Alas, by moving to recognize a Palestinian state, Britain and France have lost influence with him, too. And turning now to the main section of the magazine, we begin as usual with an article on the United States. This one is titled, Up to the Skies, U.S. Space Command is Preparing for Satellite-on-Satellite Combat. And the subheading, Stephen Whiting, the General in Charge, offers a glimpse of the near future. Towards the end of last year, a pair of military satellites, one American, the other French, prepared for a delicate orbital minuet. They were about to conduct a so-called rendezvous and proximity operation, or an RPO, in which one or more satellites approach another to inspect or manipulate it near an enemy satellite. They have not said which, but it's not hard to guess. The French have talked about Russian maneuvers near French satellites over the years, said General Stephen Whiting, speaking at the headquarters of U.S. Space Command in Colorado Springs. And so, this is a quotation, and so we demonstrated we could both maneuver satellites near each other and near other countries' satellites in a way that signaled our ability to operate well together. That's the end of the quote. The exercise was so successful, he says, that there are plans to repeat it later this year. It is a milestone, the first time that America has conducted an RPO like this, with a country outside the Five Eyes, a spy pact whose members cooperate closely in space, and the first time it was done as a purpose-built operation rather than in response to events. It also embodies America's new, more muscular approach to space. Space Command was reestablished in 2019 during Donald Trump's first term. In recent years, it has focused on building its headquarters and developing staff, and now it's ready. Quoting again, we now have a combatant command focused on warfighting in space. End quote. So says General Whiting. The impetus for that is two things. The first is that the American armed forces' reliance on satellites has compounded exponentially, says an official, pointing obliquely to America's strike on Iran in June. The majority of that operation is space-enabled. The other is what the government sees as a change in the threat. Since 2015, there's been an eightfold increase in Chinese satellite launch activity, says the official. The People's Liberation Army has become much better at operating in space, including conducting electronic warfare in orbit, he says, with China eclipsing Russia. China, Russia, and India have tested destructive anti-satellite weapons in 2017, 2021, and 2022, respectively. America also accuses Russia of developing an orbital nuclear weapon that could destroy thousands of satellites in low Earth orbit at once. A few years ago, Space Command was wary of talking about its own offensive capabilities. Now it embraces the idea. Quote, "It's time we can clearly say we need space fires and we need a weapons system. We need orbital interceptors," end quote. So says General Whiting in April. "And what do we call these? We call these weapons," he says. He points to Mr. Trump's Golden Dome plan for a missile defense shield, which includes space-based interceptors to destroy enemy missiles. In theory, the same weapons could also target enemy satellites. Space-to-space, space-to-ground, ground-to-space would all play a role in achieving the lethality that is necessary to achieve deterrence, said another official. America's allies are also becoming more open about this. In a defense review published this year, Britain said for the first time it would develop anti-satellite weapons deployed on Earth and in orbit. America leads a small but tight-knit group of spacefaring allies. In Operation Olympic Defender, Space Command works with six countries, Australia, Britain, Canada, France, Germany, and New Zealand, to, quote, deter hostile acts in space, end quote. In April, the initiative reached initial operational capability with all seven countries signing a joint campaign plan whose details will be finalized this summer. Space Command is also thinking about the tactical demands of war. "While everything in space is moving," says General Whiting, "America has thought of its satellites as individual forts that sit in one place. That's because moving a satellite takes fuel, which can shorten its lifespan." There are three solutions to that, he says. One is for satellites to just carry more fuel. Another is to refuel in orbit, something that China demonstrated in June, and that could give them a military advantage, so we need that capability. A third approach is to operate so many satellites that each one can be treated as expendable. American officials have been talking about such proliferated constellations in low Earth orbit, or LEO, for years. Think of SpaceX's Starlink. Now they're being built. America's National Reconnaissance Office, which runs classified spy satellites, has launched more than 200 since 2023, with a dozen launches scheduled for this year alone. SpaceX is also rumored to be the front runner to build a 450-strong constellation that will eventually relay missile tracking and other data from sensors to interceptors and weapons. A fourth method might be added to that list, making the satellites more intelligent. General Whiting said he would love to have AI on board satellites that would allow them to detect nefarious objects, as he put it, nearby, and move it out of the way without human intervention. In time, suggests Christopher Hun, a major in the U.S. Space Force, AI satellites could fly in close formation, meaning they could act as defender satellites to protect high-value assets in orbit. For now, the AI is mostly on the ground. In the past few months, General Whiting says, his staff's built a large language model that has been trained on all the command's threat and planning data. Officers can quiz SpaceBot on gaps in their knowledge or on how to respond to a fictional or real-world attack in space. Quote, "What would have taken 10 people 5 hours of work," he suggests, "can be done at machine speed. A space age achievement," end quote. And turning next to the section on Asia, we have an article titled "Fat Chance: Indian Firms Aim to Gorge on Weight Loss Drugs." Subheading: Domestic Demand is Surging and Indian Generics Could Make Slimming Cheaper Worldwide. Until recently, Indians had few safe ways of joining the global craze for weight loss drugs. Some smuggled them into the country when returning home from abroad, and others chanced it with bootleg versions from Dubai. But in March, Mounjaro, a weight loss drug from Eli Lilly, an American pharmaceutical giant, became legally available in India. In June, Wegovy, a drug from Novo Nordisk, a Danish firm, followed. Demand is surging. Though Indians are on average slimmer than people in most other countries, the obese population is one of the largest in the world, along with America's and China's. In Delhi, every fourth resident has type 2 diabetes. Between 2021 and 2024, Indian sales of weight loss drugs grew fivefold to $72 million. India's market could soon grow to $1 billion, predicts Jefferies, an investment bank. This may be a modest share of the $24 billion in analyzed global sales of weight loss drugs, but as the global market is set to rocket to $150 billion in annual sales in the next decade, industry insiders see India as a juicy target. Mounjaro was an instant hit. Consumption tripled from March to April, according to one industry tracker. Indian pharma is hoping to cash in. Generic firms such as Biocon are already offering weight loss drugs such as cheaper versions of an inferior first-generation injectable, liraglutide. Sun Pharma, India's biggest drugs company, hopes to launch its own jab in 5 years. The Indian market is especially lucrative because those who most need to lose weight are also best placed to pay up. In America, poorer people tend to be fatter, but in India, obesity peaks in the most prosperous southern regions and is more common among urban rather than rural populations. The university-educated are more likely to be obese, too. Indeed, the real boom will come next year. That's when the patent for semaglutide, the active ingredient of Ozempic and Wegovy, expires in India. The country's generics giants such as Cipla and Lupin will sprint to produce knockoffs. But to cash in on home turf, Indian drug firms need to beat foreign rivals by adapting a global blockbuster to Indian realities. The first reality is cost. Starting at about $200 a month, Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk's Indian offering can cost as little as a fifth of their prices in America, but a year's supply of Mounjaro or Wegovy for a single Indian can still end up being roughly the equivalent to the country's GDP per person. Indian generics will slash that figure. Some analysts predict a 95% nosedive. Second, South Asians are unusually genetically predisposed to fatty liver disease. Novo Nordisk's clinical trial suggests semaglutide might reduce it by 37%. Delivering a drug that caters to the quirks of Indian physiology gives Novo Nordisk a head start. Buckle up. Finally, consider logistics. Tirzepatide and semaglutide, the active ingredients in Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk's products, respectively, are injectable. The jabs require cold storage, and that's a tough ask in a hot country with patchy logistics chains. India's Mankind Pharma is expecting trial results by the end of 2025, which would become India's first oral weight loss drug that could rival injectables. Both Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk hope to enter this race with their own versions next year. Whoever makes a good weight loss pill will prosper, especially in rural India. India is one of the world's biggest suppliers of generic drugs, meeting about 20% of global demand. Low and middle-income countries across Africa, Latin America, and Southeast Asia have some of the fastest rising diabetes rates in the world. Dr. Reddy's, an Indian pharma giant, plans to launch a generic version of Wegovy in 87 countries when the patent expires next year, and the company is targeting Brazil, Turkey, and other emerging markets. India also supplies nearly half the generic drugs Americans consume. For now, America levies no tariffs on them, but that could change before American patents start expiring in the next decade. David Ricks, Eli Lilly's CEO, has warned that Donald Trump's tariffs could jack up the price of Indian generics. Mr. Trump has spoken of slapping 200% tariffs on pharmaceuticals. On July 30th, he threatened a 25% general tariff on India and an unspecified penalty for its stances on trade and Russia. If Indian pharma escapes the fallout, it might yet make America skinny again. And turning next to the section on Middle East and Africa, we have an article titled The Hidden Imam. Iran's supreme leader is fading into the shadows. Subheading is diminishing power makes the country's future increasingly uncertain. Political power in Iran used to be simple. Call him dictator, supreme leader, imam, or shadow of God on earth. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei was the absolute ruler. Military commanders, presidents, and clerics were his underlings. He made all the top appointments and rigged the choice of presidential candidates. But since Iran's 12-day war with Israel, things have become more complicated. The 86-year-old leader appears in public only rarely. His sermons, once lengthy, are brief. The question of succession looms larger than ever, with actors inside and outside the regime jostling for position, many openly advocating alternatives to 46 years of theocracy. The opacity around the fate of Iran's nuclear program after the strikes by Israel and America is replicated across the political system. Iranians want to know whether their leaders will accept Donald Trump's terms for a deal, but they're no longer sure who is in charge. Initially, the war appeared to stabilize Iran's politics, a war of patriotism, pulled rulers and ruled together for years after polarization. Calls by Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, for Iranians to rise up fell on deaf ears. But since the ceasefire on June 24th, the multiplicity of opinions on how to preserve unity has made the country look more fragmented. Mr. Khamenei's preferred option is cosmetic, to appeal to a population disenchanted with clerical rule. He's dressing his theocracy in nationalist clothes. During celebrations on July 5th for Ashura, the anniversary of the martyrdom of the Prophet Muhammad's grandson, and the Republic's holiest day, Mr. Khamenei ordered a cantor to drop his incantations. He told him to sing Ayar Iran, a rendition of a patriotic anthem that was popular before the Islamic Revolution in 1979 and had since been suppressed. He has played down Shia saints and puffed up Iran's pre-Islamic past. New billboards in cities give ancient Persian myths modern themes. Mr. Khamenei has also turned a blind eye to a new crop of reality shows, including a wildly popular Persian version of Love Island, where unmarried couples flirt and make out. In parts of Tehran, the capital, headscarves and long coats for women feel like a relic of the past. But such concessions are designed to reduce demand for political change and not herald its coming. Earlier this month, Mr. Khamenei reappointed his crusty Friday prayer preacher and his head of the Guardian Council, the latter, who is 99 years old, for the 33rd time. After a few post-war appearances, the state broadcaster has removed reformists from its airwaves. Executions are up. Expected amnesty for political prisoners looks far off. Entering occultation, or occultation. As the supreme leader tries to keep up the appearance of business as usual, rivals are circling. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, the regime's Praetorian Guard, is using the continued threat from Israel to justify its hold on power. Before retreating into his bunker as Israel struck, Mr. Khamenei handed decision-making to the generals, making it more likely that a military junta reduces him to a figurehead. Yet the generals are struggling to project unity. Israel's evident infiltration of their ranks has spread paranoia, complicating coordination. The IRGC's extensive business interests and unbridled corruption means some expect it to fragment into a hodgepodge of decentralized mafias. Masoud Pezeshkian, the president, has called for a dialogue with the opposition and the return of exiles in an attempt to turn the unity produced by the war into lasting reconciliation, but he lacks the clout to deliver. Iranians blame him for blackouts and lengthy water cuts in the summer heat. He's also seen as responsible for the run on the rial, having failed to persuade Iran's sanctions-busting business folk to repatriate earnings. Amid the discontent, two former presidents, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and Hassan Rouhani, are planning a comeback. Both command a larger popular base than Mr. Pezeshkian. Mr. Rouhani, a cleric, might fancy his chances as Mr. Khomeini's successor, reckoning he could end the standoff war with the West. The war, he said in a statement, should be a wake-up call to correct our course and rebuild the foundations of governance. Ali Larijani, a former Speaker of Parliament, is acting like the executive president he once tried to be. He, rather than Mr. Pesheshian, recently led a delegation to Moscow that met Vladimir Putin, Russia's president. Dissidents, too, were speaking out. On July 11th, Mir Hossein Mousavi, a former prime minister, Mr. Khamenei, is kept under house arrest, for 15 years, released a petition calling for a new constitution, which was signed by hundreds of intellectuals. Many younger Iranians want an overhaul without any past or present figures, including aging dissidents like Mr. Mousavi. Domestic disunity weighs on foreign policy, where Iran downsized its ambitions from regional domination to regime survival following Israel's pulverization of its proxies. Hardliners advocate dashing for a nuclear bomb. Others hope China, Iran's primary market for oil, may come to the rescue with new warplanes. But with Israel threatening a resumption of bombing, any help would probably come too late. Russia, mired in Ukraine, has been slow to rebuild Iran's air defenses. That leaves America. Mr. Trump's participation in Israel's war spooked Iran and put talks about a nuclear deal on hold. Abbas Araghchi, Iran's foreign minister, said Iran is ready to resume them. It might even consider a non-aggression pact with Israel. An agreement would release Iran from sanctions and end its isolation from the West, and perhaps restore foreign investment. But it's hampered by differences over where Iran should be heading. For Iranians, the decision's urgent, but they may no longer have a leader with the vision or the authority to make it. And Microsoft's net profits soared by 24% in the second quarter year-on-year to $27.2 billion as revenue from its data centers surged. The company announced even more investments in AI, and Meta's stock shot up after it reported solid earnings. Superintelligence is going to improve every aspect of the business, said Mark Zuckerberg. And in America, America could get its first ever rail operator to transport goods seamlessly from coast to coast. Union Pacific, which carries freight in the west of the U.S., agreed to buy Norfolk Southern, which operates in the east, creating a transcontinental company worth $250 billion. The deal will attract intense scrutiny from regulators and could be blown off track by objections from unions and other interested parties. And with that, we come to the end of this week's reading of The Economist. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we've been reading from the August 2nd through 8th edition of The Economist. Please join us again next week when we will again read from The Economist.